Father, thank you so much for this evening. Thanks for gathering us. Pray for tech to work smoothly. Please help us all to think rightly and wisely about your word in a way that brings truth. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Well, how can you take the Bible seriously? And by the looks of it, it looks like most of us here are kind of regulars at CCB, and that's great. Welcome. Hopefully you feel confident to share this with others, with friends who might not know the Lord. This evening is being recorded, just that the one speaking is being recorded. So feel free to share this afterwards, or an almost identical talk that I gave a few months back on YouTube as well. So that's there as well. Well, how can you take the Bible seriously? I love this question because it really does address various issues kind of underneath the question, which are all crucial issues and all issues that I take very seriously and that I feel quite strongly about. Because it suggests that there are some objections out there, doesn't it? Objections to taking the Bible seriously. And of course, there are many of varying kinds. So it may be that people have kind of worldview objections. And many people just assume a naturalist worldview, that the only truth that's out there is empirical, mathematical truth, those kind of areas. I just read a piece that Richard Dawkins wrote in The Spectator a couple of weeks ago saying that no truth compares to mathematical truth. And so we might say there's just no place for anything supernatural, any miracles, angels, resurrections, none of that. It all just sounds like fairy tales. So maybe there are objections in that area, worldview. But then there are textual objections. You might, you know, look at a bit of the Bible and think, well, isn't it full of contradictions? What about all those other texts, the other kind of controversial, didn't seem to make the, what's going on there? Was it all a bit underhand, conveniently left out? Were there sort of power games at play in the church, deciding centuries later what's good and bad for its PR? It all seems a bit dodgy. Perhaps people have objections in that area. But then there are moral objections as well, aren't there? How can a book that features slavery and polygamy and genocide, arguably, how can that possibly be a holy book? Hasn't it been used to justify misogyny, abuse, all kinds of terrible things? Surely we've progressed a long way from things like that. And we're much more enlightened now. And we don't need this dusty book from a bygone era. Well, I couldn't agree more with the principles behind those questions. Because I absolutely believe in truth. And clearly at the moment, public confidence in truth is arguably at its lowest ebb in a long time. There's so much distrust, isn't there, about the media or even scientific views, the scientific community. Trust and confidence has plummeted in recent months and years. And there's a lot of misinformation around. And there was a piece shared recently on the church Facebook group, wasn't there? A very helpful piece about how healthy skepticism can very easily slide into unhealthy cynicism. But truth matters, doesn't it? Truth matters. And so I don't want anyone to be deceived, deceived into thinking that fairy tales are reality. Or I don't want anyone to trust an untrustworthy document. I don't want anyone to base their morals on an immoral text. So I'm glad to speak to this issue. Because we'll see that you can come away from thinking about the Bible and be confident in taking it very seriously. Now, it's a pretty ambitious target to cover this whole topic in one evening. So all I'm going to do is just raise four reasons why you can take the Bible seriously and signpost you to various places to go and think more about it. First, you should take the Bible seriously because of the impact of the Bible. The impact of the Bible. Let me, I can't share my screen. Sure. Oh, yes, I can. Here we go. No, I can't. Jules, could you enable me to share a screen or make me a co-host or something? I'll share my salt of the earth kind of guy. Or we go the extra mile. Or we wash our hands of something. No peace for the wicked. All these phrases come from the Bible. It's had a colossal impact, and not only in language, but in values, the whole way that we think. And this is particularly true in the West, in Western culture. And whether we realize it or not, the air that we breathe is biblical. Non-Christian psychologist Jordan Peterson, he said this: "The Bible is, for better or worse, the foundational document of Western civilization, of Western." So that the problems we have with the Bible are even actually themselves because of the Bible. So problems of accusing that the Bible is not scientific. Well, of course, the whole scientific endeavor arose from Christian beliefs about the world, that we can understand the world scientifically. Or people object to the Bible being violent or judgmental, perhaps. Even those things spring from values about individual freedom and tolerance that are undeniably rooted in the Judeo-Christian heritage of the West. We simply wouldn't be thinking like that, raising those objections, if it weren't for the Bible and the impact it's had on our world. I'm very slowly getting through a book by Tom Holland, a non-Christian historian, about the way that the Bible has shaped the Western mind. And he says this: "The writings of the New Testament are the most influential, most impactful, most revolutionary writings that have emerged from the ancient world." And so we feel those ripple effects that have been rippling across the centuries and millennia right up to today. So we ought to think twice before severing the branch that we're sitting on. So many of the dearly held Western values about tolerance, about respect, about human rights, so many of these things spring from the Bible. The impact of the Bible has been colossal. And so it's simply sensible, reasonable, rational to examine and look at and be aware of this text that has had an extraordinary impact. So that's the first reason to take the Bible seriously, because of the impact of the Bible. Well, the second reason to take the Bible seriously is the nature of the Bible. What is the Bible exactly? Well, there's quite a bit of ignorance out there about what the Bible actually is. So it's worth just outlining a few facts. There are 66 books in here. Believe it or not, these editions make it look pretty small, but it's very, very thin paper and small print. About 40 different authors, written over about 1,500 years. So in many ways, it is a compilation. It's a library. Written in three main languages across all sorts of different places: Israel, Mesopotamia, Turkey, Southern Europe. And we can, like I say, miss the scale of the Bible. Most editions put it like this. I've also got another edition right there on my shelf. One second. This is rather nice. And this is actually, it just helps you to understand slightly more how big the Bible actually is. That's how a similar size Harry Potter series. You can look up the word count on Google later. Well, what are all these many, many books doing put together in one? Well, it's telling one epic story. Despite all those different cultures and times when the different books are composed, they are knitted together in a beautiful, extraordinary way, telling one epic story of God and his love for the world, and how the Creator, who made all that is, chose to enter this world in order to sort out the mess that we make of it. And it's beautifully interconnected, and some of the older books to the newer books, and they're very aware of each other. And this beautiful diagram shows how they all connect together. This maps out hundreds of prophecies or predictions in the Old Testament of what Jesus would then do, which are then matched to fulfillments of those prophecies hundreds of years later. Really, really amazing. And so it means that if you open up, say, Matthew's Gospel in the New Testament, it's a bit like jumping into Book 4 of Harry Potter. It only fully makes sense if you're aware of what comes before. And only when you've read what comes after Again, do you really see what it's all about? It's all very interconnected. It all hangs together. Now, when I see an ad on Instagram for something, and those annoying ads just pop up more and more, don't they? And you see something for a gadget that promises to change your life. Well, how do I respond to that? I just swipe right past it, of course. But if I were to get a letter through post tomorrow on Monday from my GP saying you are now eligible for a vaccine that could save your life from coronavirus, well, how would I treat that? I'll treat it a lot more seriously, won't I? But why the difference? Well, the difference comes because every piece of information we receive, every document, every text, if you like, we, without even thinking, we're asking questions like, where is this? Who's it for? What is it for? What's its purpose? It's what students of literature call genre. Where's it from? Who's it for? What's it for? Dr. Bill Allen is a fellow in classics at Oxford. There he is. And he's done a lot of thinking about genre. This is what he says. We can understand an ancient literary text properly only if we take into account where it comes in the evolution of its genre. Now, this is hugely important. In the interview earlier, Jacob mentioned the really unique and interesting genre of the Gospels. It's historical narrative, but kind of a bit like a biography with a certain focus on this individual, Jesus Christ, and how people reacted to him and what he said. We need to understand the genres of different kinds of writing in the Bible. And this really helps us because the Bible is full of all sorts of different things: poetry, legal documents, genealogies, narrative, prophecy, songs, a really strange one called apocalyptic. And they all have kind of different rules of the game, just like if you're reading a different kind of text. And this really helps us because it actually helps us deal with some of those moral objections. I don't know if you've ever heard someone raise problems about, you know, they say, well, the Bible, how can you take the Bible seriously? It's full of all these horrible stories of polygamy or just horrible marital and sexual relations, abuse. There's all sorts of horrible stuff in there. And there is. There's no denying that. The question is, why are they there? What's the purpose of them? In some parts of the Bible, you have letters from one person to other people. And they often include, you know, very straight imperatives. This is how you ought to live. But other writings in the Bible, say in narratives, are telling a story. And like any good story, they're communicating a valuable lesson, a valuable point for us to learn from. And in a lot of those stories, you do get, say, polygamy or even rape and all sorts of awful stuff. But they're clearly not there to be moral examples for us. Quite the opposite. You read those stories and you come away from it thinking, oh, awful. And what is God? And they're by no means moral examples to us. They're actually showing us how not to live and how desperately we need God in all sorts of ways. So remember, Instagram versus GP letter, different genres, and we need to read them differently. It also helps with apparent discrepancies in the Bible. There are some things, so John's Gospel, for example, very famous verse, God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. God loves the world. He gives his son, Jesus, to us in love. Love the world. So sometimes people read this and they think, what? Well, which one is it? God loves the world. And now he's telling me I shouldn't love the world. What's going on? It seems like a blatant contradiction, doesn't it? And yet many skilled writers will use apparent contradictions or paradox to make a point, to make you think about the meaning of those words. And Charles Dickens famously began one of his novels in here, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Is that nonsense? No, it's making a point. It's getting you to think about what was going on in those times. And many biblical writers do the same. Now, this does produce a field day for critics, though, obviously. You may have heard of Bart Ehrman. He's one of the most famous sort of popular critics of the Bible at the moment. He's written lots of books like this one, Jesus Interrupted, revealing the hidden contradictions in the Bible and why we don't know about them. Well, in the promotional video for this book on Amazon, he quotes one of the apparent discrepancies or contradictions that he goes on to refer to in the book. He says that Jesus dies in despair in Mark, but is one in control in Luke. These are diverse and contradictory portrayals. Two of the gospel accounts there, Mark and Luke, he's saying, they're just so, so different in what they're saying. There's no way you can reconcile these things. There's talking about genuine, accurate historical events. And it leaves you with the impression that there may have been historical events that happened, but we just can't really know what happens. We can't be sure of the details. And so if you know any of these stories, you might know that in Mark's gospel, Jesus, when he's dying, he cries out in agony, my God, why have you forsaken me? Seems to be in despair. Whereas in Luke, he says some other words. He says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, which seems much more at peace. But of course, to say that these are fully contradictory portrayals is just very simplistic and a false dichotomy. It's completely reconcilable. There are lots of things that could be said on this. It's almost a bit embarrassing to have to kind of go into them. Bart Ehrman takes himself quite seriously. But almost all scholars agree that Luke uses Mark as one of his sources, and that's just undeniable. Luke himself speaks of a second cry in his accounts, although he doesn't give the words to that one. And then there are many signs in each account that it's a far more complex experience than simply one is despair, one is peaceful. And there's all sorts of reasons to say that both accounts are full of those things in different ways. And so to say that one account is despair, one is peace, is a very crass oversimplification of nuance and carefully written documents. And they're not competing theologies. They're simply different emphases communicating complementary points about those historical events. Now, of course, if you're feeling cynical, you can pick apart any document to create apparent discrepancies. And it's what journalists do the whole time. It's their day job, isn't it? It's a perfectly doable exercise. But it is reasonable, it's rational. Any can put it on its own terms to consider its genre, its context, what is the author communicating and how. Taking these things into proper consideration, I challenge anyone to present an insurmountable contradiction in the Bible. Above all, like Jacob said at the start in his interview, have a read. Read it. It's extraordinarily compelling and captivating. We've thought about the impact of the Bible, the nature of the Bible. Third, I want to say a bit about the reliability of the Bible. And Jacob touched on this earlier, that book that he mentioned, The Case for Christ, would be an excellent place to read to start thinking about this historical reliability of the Bible. Now, it's true that some people will believe the Bible without really thinking about its reliability. It's also true that many disbelieve the Bible without thinking about its reliability. And skeptics will rule the headlines. They always make a scintillating headline. People like Chris Hitchens, Sam Harris, but they don't rule the academy. In our breakout room at the start, we were talking about, you know, texts that you take seriously, referring to various serious academic, you know, textbooks and things, and what determines whether you take it seriously or not. And there's all kinds of features and criteria, like, you know, peer reviews and credentials, number of sources, all that sort of stuff, isn't it? And so when someone like Michel Onfray, who's a pop French philosopher, says something like this, you've got to be careful how seriously you take it. He says, Jesus' existence has not been historically established. No contemporary documentation of the event, no archaeological proof, nothing certain exists today. I'm afraid it's just very hard not to laugh. It's totally ludicrous in terms of the academy. It's simply not what leading voices in the academy are saying, not what they've been saying for a very long time, even with the ever-growing historical and archaeological evidence at our fingertips. A much more serious voice would be one of the most highly regarded New Testament scholars, E.P. Sanders. And he says this: there are no substantial doubts about the general course of Jesus's life, when and where he lived, approximately when and where he died, and the sort of thing that he did during his public activity. Don't be deceived by scintillating headlines. Is it a bunch of fairy tales? Well, look at how some of these writings sound. We know how fairy tales begin, don't we? A long time ago, in a land far, far away, it's creating a mysterious image of a time and place that didn't really exist. Compare that with the start of Luke's gospel. Luke is one of the four accounts of Jesus's life, and listen to how he begins it. It's not like a fairy tale. Instead, he says, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea and Trachonitis, Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. It's not quite as romantic as a long time ago in a land far, far away, is it? It's very, very different. It's saying, no, look, this was an actual time and place with these real people. These are eyewitness historical accounts. And Jacob referred to some of those very interesting details, many of which show this is clearly eyewitness testimony. Now, there's been an enormous amount of research into the accuracy of the biblical documents because an awful lot hangs on it. And so thankfully, we can look at it very, very carefully, and it's fascinating and very revealing to compare what we have in the biblical text with other ancient writings. One very helpful book, if you're interested on this, is this one, Can We Trust the Gospels by Peter Williams. Very, very inspiring academic in this area. Quite short and manageable, really helpful introduction to this topic. Now, there are two key factors when it comes to discerning the reliability of an ancient text. One is the time frame between the original writing and the earliest manuscripts that we have. Time frame. The other is number. How many manuscripts do we have? Okay, because with any ancient text, whether you're talking about a historian or a Greek philosopher, whatever it is, we never have the original writing from the author's own pen. That's completely a ludicrous expectation. What we have is many, many manuscripts, many copies of that writing. So that's why those criteria are so important. What's the gap? What's the time frame between the original and all the copies that we have? Because obviously the longer the gap, the more you've got to ask questions. Is it really what the author wrote? And how many do we have? Because if you have only a few, well, it's going to be difficult to know which ones are really authentic. But if you have many, many copies, well, you can easily tell where are things being corrupted and changed and what was the author actually saying. So now look at this. This is a comparison of ancient works with the New Testament. And compare the Gospels with some of these other ancient texts. Okay, that's Homer's Iliad or Caesar's Gallic Wars. What do we have here? We got a few hundred years between them, 400 or 950, a few hundred copies, maybe up to 1,000 or 2,000. Compare that to what we have with the New Testament. We're looking at something like a 50-year time gap, much, much shorter. And thousands of copies, thousands. It's fascinating if you know anyone who's got a Greek New Testament, the language it was written in, I could show you, it footnotes all the different sources, the different manuscripts that texts come from, and they're spread all over the world. The number of manuscripts and how quickly they've spread, and it creates a whole fascinating area of study that you can sort of piece them all together to work out what the author really was saying. And it's far more doable than any of these other ancient texts because the time frame is so short and we have so many copies. And so again, it's just so encouraging if you want to take the Bible seriously when you look at something like this, the number of manuscripts we have, 4 feet is how high they would stack for the average classical writer, and yet we're looking at miles high for the texts of the Bible. We really can take the Bible seriously. Now, sometimes people raise issues about bias. Surely the biblical writers were biased. That is not an issue. It's not surprising that most of the sources we have about Jesus are Christian sources. Not surprising, is it? The question is, are they accurate? If I had to go to court to testify about a family member who was under arrest for something, the fact that I'm related to them doesn't mean that my testimony is discounted. That will be considered. But the question is it an accurate testimony? Is it a reliable testimony? Is it corroborated by other testimonies? Those are the issues. To say that it's a Christian source by no means gets rid of its reliability. Now, there's plenty more that could be said. I've just touched on a few things. Do check out that book, or the various links under the YouTube video of this talk that I gave a few months back. Above all, let me encourage you to read it. Read the Bible, and you will sense its reliability. Eyewitness details, the historical settings, the unflattering portrayals of the authors, the corroboration of other non-Christian ancient sources. We can have full confidence in what we read in this book. It's so refreshing to know this. I think especially at the moment, you know, when we are surrounded by many unreliable words, aren't we? It's so easy to criticize our political leaders at the moment, but they have a nightmare on their hands, don't they? I mean, who would want to be them at the moment? But you can't deny that you know, their data is constantly changing, the situation is constantly changing. And so whenever they say something, it's kind of hard to know how to take it, isn't it? Because who knows in a few weeks' time whether they're going to have to go back on what they've said. That's kind of what we're getting used to at the moment. And so obviously it breeds quite a lot of cynicism and resentment and all sorts of things. How refreshing to know that we have a text that is completely reliable. We can read it and know that what it says is true and unchanging. These words can bring tremendous stability and peace in a world of confusion. Well, lastly, and more briefly, fourth reason why we can take the Bible seriously, because of the message of the Bible. I love the Jason Bourne films. I don't know if anyone else did. I once watched all four in a marathon at a stag do. And they begin with this mysterious character, Jason Bourne, very good initials, by the way, JB. And he's desperately wounded, very mysterious. He doesn't know what's going on. He's entirely anemic. And yet gradually he sort of discovers that he has extraordinary skills and strengths. And so begins the quest of him working out, who is he? Why is he there? Why is he the way that he is? What's the story? What can explain who he is? And it's actually a pretty compelling illustration of our human condition. We find ourselves here in this world with all sorts of skills and strengths, as well as weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And it makes us ask the question, well, who really are we? Where have we come from? Why are we here? What's the story? What's the story that explains who we are? Well, it's a massive and daunting question, isn't it? And to cope with the scale of this question, we have to adopt some kind of governing narrative, a kind of meta narrative, a great big story that we think makes sense of the world. And if not, you just crumble into despair. And we need some kind of narrative that makes sense of our existence. Some opt for a religious meta narrative, some focus on a kind of socio-political progression, some focus on a more individual and kind of happiness focused narrative. What do you opt for? What narrative do you rely on that makes sense of the world? Well, I'm sure you have heard of Mahatma Gandhi, the Indian reformer and activist. And he once said something very interesting to a bunch of Christian missionaries. Here's what he said. You Christians look after a document containing enough dynamite to blow all civilization to pieces, turn the world upside down, and bring peace to a battle-torn planet. But you treat it as though it's nothing more than a piece of literature. So remember what I was saying before about genre and things like that? It is a piece of literature. We need to read it on its own terms. But it's so much more than that as well. So much more. And he's right. The Bible does have that kind of power to bring peace and reconciliation, because its narrative is uniquely and utterly beautiful and compelling. It's the great eternal story of how a God of infinite power and tender mercy not only created all that is, but entered that creation. It means that human beings are not just an irrelevant part of the food chain, but no, we are divinely dignified, eternally valuable beings. And as God enters the world as a tiny human baby at Christmas in order to live alongside us, and even then to serve us and sacrifice himself to save us from the mess that we make of our own lives and the world. So you see, it's one epic, amazing story. It's not just a moral code. It's a story, the great story, the ultimate story of triumph through adversity, of hope from despair. And this is the ultimate story that we hear in all other decent stories. You know, think of the Disney films or Batman stories. It's epic quests, isn't it? It's rags to riches. It's defeating the great monster at the end. It's the prince marrying the pauper and living happily ever after. All those things that resonate with us so deeply in Disney Pixar films, they resonate because they connect with the one great true story. C.S. Lewis, one of the greatest minds in literature, he initially objected to the Bible, thinking that it was just another set of myths. He was an expert in ancient myths. But then when he looked at it more carefully, he came to conclude this. He saw that the Bible, the Gospels, the story of Jesus is a true myth. A myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with this tremendous difference, that it really happens. It's the grand story that makes sense of all other stories. And so let me just end by explaining what it is that really makes the Bible so unique. The unique claim of this book is that it is not only a human book, but also a divine book. Now you might think, well, that's not unique. Isn't that what all holy books say? Well, no, it's not actually. And the Bible doesn't claim to be like the Quran. The Quran is supposed to be simple dictation. That is, God just speaks from heaven and then it's dictated and written down as to what he says. There's not really any human agency in there. Or the Book of Mormon just appeared sort of mysteriously after supposedly having been hidden for thousands of years in a language that no one knows. The Bible, very different, much more human than that. Yes, these are human writings, human languages, and you can even get a sense of the human character of many of the writers about real historical human events. And yet, at the same time, behind it all, God was directing the writing of that story, so that what the human authors wrote is exactly what he intended them to write. There's a verse in the Bible that puts it like this. Prophets, though human, spoke from God as they were carried along by the Holy Spirit. The Bible claims to be at the same time human and divine. So why not have a read and see what you think? If you listen, you will hear God speaking. We can take the Bible seriously because of the impact of the Bible, the nature of the Bible, the reliability of the Bible, and the message of the Bible. Do have a read, and why not read it with your friends and have a talk about it, have a think about it. The most significant writing in the world. Well, thanks for listening. I've been able to see a few thumbnails on my screen as I've spoken, and I'd love us to go into group scriptures. Would probably be the most, it would probably be where I would start. And he takes those writings as having full divine authority. He says not one letter is going to change ever from it. And he constantly quotes it, refers to it, and says that he's come to live in the light of it, to fulfill it. So if we are going to take it seriously as a historical document, then you find yourself with this historical figure, Jesus Christ, and how he is treating the Old Testament writings of the Bible. And so I think that then sort of gets you on a trajectory of, well, okay, if I'm at all convinced or drawn into who Jesus seems to be and what he seems to be saying, then I'm going to take what he says quite seriously. And you see how he treated the Old Testament and then how he made provision for the writing of the New Testament through the uniquely inspired New Testament writers. So that's probably the place I'll start. And then you kind of find yourself having to deny one or the other. Either you're going to say, actually, I don't really take it seriously historically. I'm just going to throw it out the window. Or, okay, well, if I am going to take it seriously, then I'm going to have to really deal with what Jesus says about the authority of God's word. So I'll probably go somewhere along those lines. Kind of.
Yeah, true.
Supernatural involvement in the world. And
true. Yeah.
So that would be something a bit like Andy was just saying, you know, asking questions about authority. You can ask questions about, well, what's made you convinced of how you see the world? And, you know, if you dig a bit, if you can, you end up coming up against some of the stuff that Tom Holland writes about in that book I quoted, that so many of the even the scientific and philosophical criteria that we have these days for what is good and true come from a biblical viewpoint. So, you know, even the every Christian scientist will be keen to point out the fact that the whole scientific endeavor in the West was born out of a viewpoint, or at least a theistic viewpoint, that there is an intelligent God out there.
Yeah. Is Tom Holland, is that In the Case for Christ, or is that a different book you're thinking of?
No, sorry, that's Tom Holland is a non-Christian historian who has written about lots of ancient history, Persia, Greece, Rome, and his most recent book is called Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind, and it's about the influence of Jesus Christ.
Can I also possibly come in here and just mention that there is a really good book by a Christian mathematician at Oxford called John Lennox, called God's Undertaker, which I've pulled from my shelf very quickly. It's very short, it's about 200 pages, and it essentially makes the point that from a scientific perspective, rather than you can absolutely be a Christian and a scientist, and that the two worldviews are not incompatible at all. And he talks about things like the absurd fact that the earth exists and the extreme mathematical improbability that we can walk about and not be fried by the sun and stuff like that. So it's a very, very good read.
Could you what's the name of the book again? Who's it by?
I'll put it in the chat.
Okay.
Also, there is a book by the same person.
Oh yeah, John. Yeah. Same person.
We've got another talk in this series actually coming up from Professor Richard Buggs, who's a biologist at Queen Mary University in London, and he's going to be talking about evolution, that whole area.
That's good.
There are lots of very highly qualified Christian scientists out there. Speak and write on these kind of issues. So for more of the technical scientific side of things, those would be the people you need to.
Okay, thanks. And also, sorry, about the reliability of the Old Testament versus New Testament.
Yeah, thank you. I'm less well clued up on that, but there is a whole field of study. There is more that's been done on the New Testament because it's just more recent. But that's not to say that, you know, there's not textual criticism that goes on of the Old Testament manuscripts. Like how I answered Will's question before, I think it was, I've always found it a helpful way into the area to start with Jesus. Because if, I guess the logic works like this. If, you know, if the documents we have about Jesus really are as historically reliable and accurate as I believe they are from what I shared earlier, then you have to take him and everything he says really, really seriously. And so seriously that he claims to be, you know, the unique God man, God come to earth. And so if he treats the Old Testament seriously, if he treats it as divinely authoritative, then that is, I mean, the killer reason to do so. But that's not to say that we don't need to look into it. There's no value in looking into it historically and textually and so on. There is, and that, that work goes on. But that in itself, I think, should give us a lot of confidence. And I'll look for some other things to point you to on that, because I said at the start of the talk that I would point you to various things.
Okay.
And I haven't yet anything on the Old Testament, so I will
have. There's also again, sorry to jump in, resident historian, but I'd say a lot of the historical evidence for the Old Testament is archaeological in nature rather than textual. So it's a different kind of history. If you look up, for instance, the cylinders of Nabonidus, which attests to a central part of Daniel, which describes what's happening in Babylon. The fact is that these are texts. The Old Testament is a text in time, and so because it's further back from the New Testament, there's less kind of texts, other texts going on. But there's a lot of archaeology. I can put something in the chat on that as well.
Oh, thank you.
And also, most people's questions just come down to genre and a misunderstanding of it. So they think, oh, you're a Christian, you take must take the Bible literally, that means you think the world's 6,000 years old or something like that. And actually just being able to speak intelligently of how to read those early chapters of Genesis is very important. I think it's before you arrive, Helen, but I preached through the first 11 chapters of Genesis. They're on the website. And along the way, I peppered in a few thoughts about how we handle those discussions about how we understand the Genesis 1, how we understand the accounts talking snake. What about the ridiculous ages of people in the genealogies? What about is it a global or a local flood? Those are some of the big discussions, and that might be helpful.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, you should have been at church then.
Sorry.
You're at a different church, that's allowed.
Oh, before I arrived at church, I thought you meant before I arrived today.
No, it's before.
I was thinking that would be a lot to cover in 20 minutes.
Yeah, no, that was before you were at CCB.
Okay.
They're on the website.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Helen. Lots of really helpful questions in there.
I've got a question. Obviously, the Bible wasn't originally written in English. So how do we know that that things haven't been lost in translation? And also the fact that there's like loads of different English translations as well. Like, why do we use the NIV, and like, how do we know that's the best one to use?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. In terms of the language, this is why biblical studies is really valuable. And so we're thankful that people like Andy, who lead churches, have done a lot of study and even into biblical languages and things. Because obviously everyone involved in literature knows that it is possible to translate, but translation always comes with some cost. So you can never fully capture the sense of the original language, but you can adequately capture it to communicate its meaning. And so most sort of confessions of faith, these kind of statements of, you know, what Christians believe, refer to the biblical texts being inspired or given by God as originally written. So that is the original languages, because then we do acknowledge that they have to be translated. So there's, and then of course there are many ways to translate anything on there. And that's basically why we have so many different translations, because lots of people have slightly different attitudes to, well, how are we going to translate this? Do we opt for a kind of word for word translation? So whenever the word for, I don't know, house appears, you always translate it with exactly the same word, or do you have a slightly more sort of translation where you're more concerned about the sort of feel and communicating the sense of the original rather than word for word? And that's a whole spectrum. So different translations, you can sort of plot along that spectrum, more or less. We opt for the NIV because it kind of is more or less in the middle of that spectrum. It's generally very careful with its translation, and doesn't just sort of sit loose to what the actual words are written there for. But it's not as extreme as some versions in that it also aims for a bit of readability. So it's kind of trying to do a bit of the best of both. But, you know, occasionally you might hear one of us in a sermon saying, it's quite helpful to bear in mind what the original Greek word was here, for example, because sometimes it is just really hard to communicate that in a different language. So I hope that
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful. Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks.